Good afternoon, Your Honors. Ashley Ratliff, 37870, on behalf of a tourist trainer. May it please the court. The tourist trainer was convicted of non-homicide crimes committed when he was a 17-year-old juvenile, operating like that of a second grader. Yet he was sentenced to a term of 224 years, later reduced to 112 years in the Department of Corrections. What difference is there between 112 years in prison and life without parole? There is no difference. The United States Supreme Court has declared life sentences imposed upon juvenile offenders to be unconstitutional. Graham versus Florida is talking about youth. Youth matters, youth are different, youth like a tourist trainer. Yet the court treated a tourist trainer like an adult in crafting a sentence that would exceed his life expectancy. Pre-sentence confinement credit and parole, the court deemed moot, meaningless. It was a judgment at the outset to an irrevocable term of years, a sentence of life in prison.
Can I ask you, Ms. Ratliff, I guess I'm going to focus in on the standard you're asking us to adopt. Graham, of course, talks about having a meaningful opportunity for release. And you talked about, both here and in your brief, the question of exceeding Mr. Rayner's life expectancy. Is the standard exceeding life expectancy? Is it close to life expectancy? For example, say life expectancy is 73. Is it good enough? Does it satisfy Graham if he's 72? Or what if the youth offender is sick, has some kind of disease that makes life expectancy shorter? Do we factor that in? How do we measure this rule that you're asking us to adopt?
What Graham requires is providing a meaningful opportunity for release based upon demonstrated growth and maturity. And a sentence which exceeds life expectancy, a sentence which goes into the hundreds, does not provide any meaningful opportunity for release or for the offender to demonstrate that growth and maturity.
So let me pick up on that a little bit here. Assuming that we agreed with your legal position that Graham does apply here, and we had to send this back to the trial court, what's the remedy? What would the trial court do here to impose a sentence that, in your view, would be constitutional under Graham? And let me ask it even more specifically. In the trial court, the defense lawyer specifically asked the court to impose a minimum, 72 years. Okay? As I understand it, under the applicable statutes, he's first eligible for release if he serves 50% of his time. So that would be after 36 years. So instead of, he would have the potential to get out when he's in his mid-50s. Is that a constitutional sentence?
Well, it's the number of years, but it's also the process.
Well, let's assume that the judge goes through and says, I'm taking into account your age and all the developmental issues that were talked about in Graham. I'm doing all that. I'm going to sentence you to 72 years, and you have a chance of getting out 36 years.
Without...
And I realize that that's not the sentence that's in front of us, but it kind of picks up on what Judge Gabriel was saying. What are the parameters that we're looking at here? Assuming your statistics are right about life expectancy.
It would be up to the trial court to fashion a sentence within their broad discretion of what a meaningful opportunity for release means based on the juvenile before them, based on the developmentally delayed juvenile before them, to sentence that person based not just on the crimes, but based on all the factors that you just described and talked about. The mitigating factors of the tourist's youth and the offenses together is what Graham requires and what Miller followed with in their analysis of Graham. it would be a remand to the court for a full and fair resentencing hearing. That didn't happen here for Mr. Rayner. The process of looking at the mitigating factors of his youth was not followed. And Colorado law at that time said specifically age is not a factor for the court to consider, but now Graham says it is. And so it would be a sentence fashioned in a way that the trial court, in their discretion, with a full evidentiary hearing of all the different factors that come into play based on the person before them.
Good.
Let me ask one more question as a follow-up. Prior to Graham, the law on proportionality, the constitutional proportionality in Colorado, seemed pretty clear. You had the close case which said it's based on the severity of the crime, and then you also said you don't look at an aggregate sentence, you look at individual sentences. So is it your position that Graham has effectively, for these kinds of cases, overruled close?
Yes, for juvenile offenders, yes.
Thank you.
So I was going to ask you, Ms. Ratliff, let's say the court, hypothetically, we do agree, the court does all the things you're suggesting, looks at Mr. Rayner's youth, his developmental delays, all of that, looks at the statistics you had, and then says, I think 71 is okay, 70, he gets out of 71 years old, that's a meaningful opportunity for release. Is that good enough? And does that satisfy Graham in your view? The judge has now looked at all the factors you're suggesting, youth and everything else. I guess what I'm trying to drill down to is, what is meaningful opportunity for release? I understood from your brief, and I may misunderstand it, that you're suggesting if as long as the sentence exceeds his life expectancy, it violates Graham. Are we looking for a black line like that? Life expectancy is it, or what?
Not necessarily. What we're saying is that 112 years and the way that the sentence was crafted in this case is unconstitutional. Graham requires a meaningful opportunity for release. It doesn't define what that bright line rule or number of years, and other cases in states which have dealt with a similar issue have taken the case before it and said that's unconstitutional and remanded for resentencing for the trial court to use their discretion and look at the person before them and all the different factors in which you craft a sentence that's constitutional, doesn't violate the Eighth Amendment, and follows Supreme Court precedent, Graham followed by Miller versus Alabama.
And I guess, and I don't mean to keep beating a dead horse, so I apologize to you about it. You're asking us, I think, to apply Graham, but you need a meaningful opportunity for release. And perhaps what you're suggesting is that we don't have to decide the parameters in this case, because whatever it is in this case, it's 112 years, it clearly, he doesn't have a meaningful opportunity. Maybe that's what you're suggesting. I'm just concerned because we have to adopt some rule in this case, and if we, you know, go with where you're going, I'm not quite sure what the rule would be.
Well, and that's correct, Judge. What we're saying is that 112 years is unconstitutional, and that a full and fair sentencing hearing for a Torres Rayner is required, which the trial court, with broad discretion, can fashion a sentence that can fit within the parameters of Graham. The sentence now, as it stands, does not comply with Graham or United States Supreme Court precedent.
Well, let me expand on that a little bit, because is it really the 112 years that's at issue here? Because under the statutes that were in effect at the time, he has the opportunity to be released if he serves 50 years worth of it, 50% of his sentence. But as you said in your brief, even that takes him into 75 years old. So which date are we looking at? I mean, the 112 is relevant, but even under the old statutes, he has at least the possibility. The question is serving 50% of that 112 year sentence, does he have a reasonable opportunity to get out?
He does not. And that's the argument that was being made with life expectancy.
I understand that. So, but it's not so simple just to say 112 years is too long. It's more nuanced than that, which is, I think, the argument you're making in your brief.
That's correct, Judge. And that would be a factor for the court, the trial court, in fashioning a sentence that would then be constitutional.
Ms. Ratliff, I want to switch gears a little bit because the trial court found that Graham should not be applied retroactively, and certainly the people argue that. Could you please address that argument?
If you could repeat the question.
The question on retroactivity, the trial court found below that Graham should not be applied retroactively in this case, and that people have also asserted that position on appeal. So I'd like to have your comment on that.
My understanding, and I would let the Attorney General speak, is that the Attorney General is not disputing the retroactive application of Graham versus Florida. Our position is that Graham is retroactive, has been applied retroactively, and applies clearly in the Forest Rangers case. It is a new rule of constitutional law that applies to his situation.
Your argument, it's a new rule of substantive law. We don't even get it, the Teague versus Lay, as others do, right?
That's correct. A Torres Rainer is entitled to a fair sentencing hearing that factors in all the mitigating qualities of his youth. Unlike the court that fashioned a sentence stacking maximum consecutive mandatory terms together to create a sentence of life in prison. Vacating the unconstitutional sentence that is currently cruel and unusual, and a remand for a resentencing hearing that is consistent with United States Supreme Court precedent. I would ask to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You may. Thank you very much, Ms. Ratliff.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Jones. My registration number is 31044, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. I would like to begin just as an initial matter. People are not contesting the retroactive application of Graham and Miller. It is, however, our position that the court need not reach a determination on retroactivity because Graham and Miller do not apply to the sentences at issue here, because these are term of year sentences, and that is outside the scope of Graham. Now, Graham held that a juvenile...
Ms. Jones, I'm sorry, yes. If I can interrupt you before I get to that. You're going to get to the merits, and I definitely want to hear about it. But you also spent a lot of your brief arguing time bar and successiveness. Could you address that? You know, as you said in your brief, and spent most of the time in your brief telling us we shouldn't even reach the merits. So would you, I guess, I'll throw it out there in terms of successiveness. How can you at once not contest retroactivity and then deny that this is that it's a new rule, which you would have to kind of get out of the exception under successiveness?
To the extent that Miller and Graham were to apply to the facts here, which the people are contending that they do not, then we would not be arguing that the case was time barred or barred as successive. However, to the extent that these facts fall outside of Graham and Miller and are not controlled by Graham and Miller, they are subject to the same time bars and rules of criminal procedure as any other claim under 35C. So it is our position that Miller does not even apply here, Graham does not even apply here. So whether or not those cases are retroactive is irrelevant to the determination of this claim on appeal.
So as I understand it, I think what you're saying is all of the procedural arguments you are making, time bar, successiveness, retroactivity, depend on the really the merits.
Yes, they depend on whether or not you determine that Miller and Graham apply to the facts of this case.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt you.
No. Now, going back to Graham, because we do have to determine whether or not Graham applies here in order to determine whether or not we look at things like the time bar and whether or not the claims are successive, we have to look at the analysis that the court engaged in determining whether or not these life without parole sentences were unconstitutional. And what Graham held was that a life without parole sentence for a juvenile for a non-homicide offense is unconstitutional. And they reached that conclusion by looking both at whether or not there was a national consensus against this sentencing practice, and then they went on to make an independent determination regarding whether or not this type of punishment violates the Constitution. Now, the first part of this analysis, looking at whether or not there's a national consensus, the court spent a great deal of time looking at the laws and sentencing practices of the states and the federal courts, and they relied heavily on the Amino study, and they came to the conclusion that there were only 123 of these juveniles who were serving these life without parole sentences. And of those juveniles, that was only occurring in 11 different states. So the court found that this was an exceedingly rare sentencing practice. And of course, the court found that Colorado was not one of these states where these juveniles are serving these types of sentences.
Well, the court didn't actually find that. It just didn't mention Colorado in any of its statistics, did it?
It actually does mention Colorado, and there are footnotes at the end listing all of the different states and what their sentencing practices are toward the end of the opinion. But again, the court, in looking at this, it did not look at lengthy term of year sentences for juveniles.
Well, let me ask you, if I may, Ms. Jones, what do you do about the, you're, I think, proceeding from the premise that the court was just dealing with life without parole sentence de jure, an official life without parole sentence. What do you do about the language and the conclusion of the case, which on the opinion is a state need not guarantee the offender eventual release, but if it imposes a sentence of life, it must provide him or her with some realistic opportunity to obtain release. What do you do about that language?
If the court imposes a sentence of life without parole, then they have to provide a meaningful opportunity for release. Here we don't have a sentence of life without parole. What we have is a sentence to a term of years. And albeit lengthy, that's not the type of situation that the court was confronted with in Graham.
So you don't you see a distinction if the court sentenced Mr. Rainer to 1,000,000 years, no parole ever. You see that as distinct from life without parole?
That is distinct from what occurred in Graham. And I think the reason that's so is because when the court was looking at whether or not there was a national consensus against this type of sentencing practice, they were really focused on the rarity of this, the rare instances where courts are imposing life without parole in juveniles. Had the court actually considered the number of juveniles serving lengthy term of year sentences, the numbers would have been drastically different, and it's entirely possible that the court wouldn't have found there was a national consensus against this type of sentencing practice.
But before it even got to this issue of national consensus and all of that, did the court really frame its argument or its holding based on what they initially decided in Roper with all this data about treating juveniles different from adults? Wasn't that essentially the bedrock of its reasoning? And why would it be different in a case where an argument is that it's a de facto sentence for life? Why would any of that be different?
Well, again, I think that if you look at the language of Graham, what the court did was it did take on this two-part analysis. And certainly a large part of the court's analysis had to do with the differences between juveniles and adults and the reasons that make juveniles different. However, before the court even got that far, it determined that there was a national consensus against this type of sentencing practice. And in reaching that conclusion, it focused on the rarity of these types of sentences, the fact that these sentences don't occur except for in a handful of cases. 123 cases across the country is all that the court was able to come up with. And when we're looking at term of year sentences, that's very different. Had the court been presented with that data, which of course we don't have here, the analysis might have been very different. The ultimate conclusion might have been very different.
But Ms. Jones, we're not really dealing with term of years. We're dealing with term of years with a parole that's so out there in terms of life expectancy that it's de facto life without parole. So it's a little bit different from just saying a term of year sentence. So really going back to, I think Judge Gabriel's decision is, when you have Eric's question, when you have a de facto life without parole, why doesn't Graham's reasoning apply?
Well, again, I would argue that in this case, first of all, this is not a de facto life without parole sentence. I would also argue that the case, or the charges in this case, should be treated as homicide charges based on the language presented in Graham. And then this case would fall under Miller, which doesn't prohibit a life without parole sentence. It only prohibits a mandatory life without parole sentence, which isn't what this was here. Here the court was able to exercise its discretion in imposing the sentence that it did, and it was able to take into account the different mitigating factors in imposing the sentence. And when the court in Graham, it said basically that there's a difference between defendants who kill, intend to kill, or foresee that life has been taken. In this case, we have a defendant who was convicted of two counts of attempted murder, and the jury found that he intended to kill the two victims in his case.
But he didn't.
He did not. But again, going on, the Amino study that's relied on heavily by the court defines homicide as both murder, attempted murder, and felony murder. And the defendant in the Miller case, Jackson, he was actually convicted of felony murder. And in that case, he hadn't fired the gun, nor was there evidence that he intended to kill his victims. But the Miller court still found that the only problem with his sentence was the mandatory nature of the life without parole, not life without parole generally.
Well, let me ask you this. As far as I, in the trial court, the prosecution never filed a response to the motion here. So this argument about these being homicide offenses is being made for the first time on appeal. Can we consider that argument?
Yes, Your Honor, the argument comes directly from the language in Graham itself. And of course, that case was cited by both sides on appeal. So this idea that these are actual homicide offenses comes directly from the language in Graham. The study that they cited defines these attempted murder cases as homicides. When the court's talking about worldwide treatment of these types of offenses and it looks at Israel, which is the only other country that imposes life without parole for juveniles, there they also define homicide as homicides or attempted murders. So really the language of Graham, the crux of Graham, the language talking about the difference between the defendants who kill or intend to kill versus these other types of serious non-homicide offenses, it really is at the crux of what Graham's getting at. Is that these homicide offenses are to be treated differently. And when you're looking at an attempted homicide, we still have that same intent to kill, which puts it in a different category of cases than the non-homicide cases that the court's talking about in Graham.
If I can ask you, Ms. Jones, let's assume, I understand the argument you're making about Graham. You take a narrower view than your opponent about what it stands for. Would you agree that at least a district court in sentencing a juvenile needs to consider issues like youth and intellectual development and the like based on Graham and Roper and cases like that?
And the court in this case did so.
How? That's exactly what was going to be my next question, because it didn't seem like the court did to me, frankly.
Well, the defendant made arguments both about the defendant's age, the length of time that he would spend in prison, his mental capacity, the lack of a father figure in his life. The court touched on all of those things in sentencing. I believe it's pages 18 through 20. The court made specific comments where he recognized the age of the defendant, the length of years he would serve in prison due to his age, the fact that he had a lesser mental capacity, the fact that he was without a father for the majority of his life. The court took into consideration all of those mitigating factors in imposing the sentence in this case, and still decided, based on the horrendous nature of the facts of this case, that the maximum sentence on each count was appropriate here. So the court did engage in the very discretion that Miller asks for.
So can you give me the cite again to where the court actually considered the issue of age? I will grant you that the court talked about his low IQ, about his family history, but and I may have just missed it, but where is the cite where the court actually in the record says, I'm taking into account his age?
I believe it's on page 18, but I have page 18 to 20 in volume 3 listed in my notes, so it may be throughout those pages. But the court did recognize that the defendant was 20 years of age at the time of sentencing, and that with a lengthy sentence, he would be spending a great deal of time in prison. Additionally,
let me just interrupt you for a second. Would you concede, though, that what the court did not do was take into account all of these social science studies and that analysis that the Supreme Court went through in Graham?
It did not consider, and again, defense counsel didn't present any of those for the court to consider either.
Well, he didn't have defense counsel.
At sentencing?
Well, I guess maybe at sentencing, certainly not in the post-conviction.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Now, again, even assuming that we were to apply Graham to this case, which again, people are arguing does not apply to this case, the defendant didn't even receive a de facto life without parole sentence here. Now, the defendant was sentenced to a total of 112 years, and I think we have to look at both, not only just when he's first eligible for parole based on serving 50% of his sentence, but I think we also need to consider the fact that he's eligible for earned time credit while he's serving time in prison. And what Graham was really after was to give these juveniles an opportunity to demonstrate maturity and rehabilitation. That's exactly what earned time does in these cases.
But you don't make that argument in your brief. You don't give us those statistics.
Well, it's not statistics, it's just the sentencing laws. And
Well, you know, I mean, the trouble that I have is we've got a bit of a hole in the record here. I mean, we have this life expectancy data that's given to us by the defendant that doesn't seem to be in dispute. But then we don't have you making the argument or presenting any material to the trial court to say, look, the guy has a chance of getting out when he's not 75, when he's 70 or 65 or 60. So what do we do with that?
Well, again, Your Honor, originally, it's the people's position that these cases do not apply here.
I understand.
So, and then if they do apply, it's our argument that this particular case falls under Miller, in which case a life without parole sentence does not violate the Constitution as long as it is not mandatory. If we go a step further, and if I am to take what defense counsel is arguing, which is that Graham does apply here, then my response to that is that we must consider not only the fact that he has to serve 50% of his sentence, but we have to consider anything else that would affect his parole eligibility date. Because really all that Graham is asking for here is a reasonable opportunity, some meaningful opportunity to obtain release. If we are giving these juveniles the opportunity to earn time credit that then lowers the amount of time they have to spend in prison, it's up to them to take advantage of this, and the court should be considering that in determining when their actual parole eligibility date is.
Ms. Jones, when would that get him out? We don't have that information in the record. What does the earned time credit do? Will he be 70?
Well, if we look at the statute, the maximum amount of earned time credit he can earn is 30%. And then he's eligible for release after he serves 50% of that time, if we look at the sentencing statutes. I would argue that you would have to infer the maximum amount of earned time credit available because that's the maximum opportunity that's presented to these juvenile defendants.
Do you have any case law that supports that?
That supports...
That's how we should view the earned time, that we should assume that it's the maximum?
Well, again, I would point to the language in Graham that says all the courts are required to do is give these defendants a meaningful opportunity for release. Well, we have built into our statutes a meaningful opportunity for these defendants to obtain an earlier release date based on earning earned time credit.
Well, as a procedural matter, let's assume you're right. Doesn't this count, were we hypothetically to agree that Graham applied here or Miller applied, isn't this the kind of thing we should send back on remand for a new sentencing and then you could make all these arguments to the trial court and let the trial court weigh it?
Well, and again, of course, the people are arguing that a resentencing is not necessary because these cases do not apply here.
But if they did, if we go that way, would the remedy be a resentencing and then allow everyone to put on all these statistics and to let you try to earn credit or anything?
But I don't think that a resentencing is appropriate here. The court has already considered all of the mitigating factors and imposed a sentence that it believed to be appropriate based on the facts of this case. Earned time credit and parole eligibility is just a matter of statute.
I understand that, Ms. Jones, but if we were to hold that Graham applies or Graham's reasoning applies, I know you disagree. Assume we go that way. Shouldn't we then send it back for resentencing and allow both sides to put on statistical evidence and let you make this earned time credit argument? You're kind of suggesting we should look at that, and I don't see how we could.
Well, I think because what's written is very clear, that the earned time credit can reduce his sentence by up to 30%. Parole eligibility, he has to serve at least half of what's remaining. That's just defined by statute. There's nothing to place before the trial court that requires the court's discretion. Now, it's possible in a case where if it was such that the amount of years was so far beyond any life expectancy that we could imagine, then it might be necessary to do a resentencing. But here in this case, even if you took out the earned time credit, he's going to be eligible for parole at 75. That's certainly within life expectancy. The trial court in this case, in ruling on his 35C, found that 35 years was not a life sentence in this case.
But statistics show 75 is beyond his life expectancy, and so far you haven't disputed those statistics.
Well, those statistics were not before the trial court when it was ruling on his 35C. The trial court wasn't presented with any of those statistics when the defendant asked the court to rule on his 35C. So to say that the court erred in not considering studies that were presented to it at the time it made its ruling, it's difficult to see how the court should have made a different decision at that time.
But the defendant did cite certain statistics in his motion.
Because Graham wasn't decided at the time of sentencing either.
Very true, Your Honor. But again, it's our position that Graham only applies to the actual life without parole sentence, not to the term of year sentence at issue here.
So before we let you go, let me ask another question. So there have been a lot of cases around the country talking about this issue. There were a bunch cited in the opening brief. You didn't cite any answer in your answer brief, but you did cite a couple in your supplemental authority, as did the defendant.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you respond to the numerous cases that have gone the defendant's way on this kind of cases, And I grant you that there are cases going the other way. Do we have to deal with those just by saying they were wrongly decided? We just disagree?
Well, it's California is the multitude of cases coming out the defendant's way are all from California. I believe Florida has a bit of a split in dealing with these issues. But again, yes, it is my position that those cases are wrongly decided.
Okay.
If the court has no further questions, we would ask that the court affirm the trial court's order denying the defendant's motion for post-conviction relief.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. Ms. Ratliff. Got 8 minutes and 23 seconds.
I'd like to begin with a couple of arguments that were made for the first time here today that I would ask the court to not consider, one of which Judge Loeb remarked may be something for the trial court to consider at sentencing. The idea of earned time and what that factors into a sentence would be something for the court to look at, trial court, a new sentencing hearing within their discretion. And additionally, that the crimes are considered homicide crimes. That this court should not consider that argument for the first time today. But what's more is that Miller's evaluation of Graham says nothing of what Graham said about children, about youth, is crime specific. Additionally, the Attorney General's position is that the only sentence that qualifies here is a specific sentence in name of life without parole. However, life without parole, no parole, means no meaningful opportunity for release. So the sentence here with the Torres Rainer fits squarely within the mandate of Graham. It does not provide a meaningful opportunity for release.
Well, let me ask the flip side of Judge Loeb's question to Ms. Jones to you. There are cases that actually conclude the opposite, that they do say life without parole means life without parole. This wasn't a life without parole sentence. And there are cases that say Graham doesn't reach here. Do you just think those are wrongly decided? Or are they distinguishable some other way?
Yes, Judge, that's correct. And there is a split of authority on what states are doing in the application of Graham. I believe in a couple of those cases, they set out and even remark on how 107 years is no different than life without parole, but Graham didn't narrowly, specifically say when a sentence that is crafted in such a way, stacked mandatory sentences together, applies, and if the Supreme Court's going to do so, they can. But they do even, I believe it was the Henry case, that even remarks on how there is no difference between 107 years and life without parole.
So you'd say those cases take too narrow a view and you disagree with those?
Exactly. The sentencing court never considered youth. Not once did the court, or anyone for that matter, mention the fact that Torres Rainer was a juvenile offender. His age, they say he was 20 at the time of sentencing, was touched about in passing. And the fact about his father and other issues, the court actually treated as aggravating and said, that terrifies me, that's scary. We don't want this pattern to continue. You need to basically go away to prison for the rest of your life. And crafted the sentence based on the crime. I believe repeats that crafting of the sentence. Mandatory maximums, and said that's what the legislature intended on every single count for your prison sentence. That does not factor in the mitigating factors of a Torres Rainer's youth. And that must occur for his sentence to be constitutional, and the sentence must provide for a meaningful opportunity for release. The United States Supreme Court has squarely rejected the notion of treating youth as an aggravating factor. Rather, in Miller, the court talks about how the mitigating factors of youth counsel against a lifetime in prison, and how the courts must look at how those qualities, immaturity, lessened culpability, susceptibility to negative peer influences, capacity for change, how that goes against sentencing someone to a term of years, to a lifetime of in prison. A Torres Rainer sentence, just like Terrence Graham, guarantees he will die in prison without any meaningful opportunity to obtain release. No matter what he might do to demonstrate that the bad acts he committed as a teenager are not representative of his true character, and even if he spends the next half century attempting to atone for his crimes and learn from his mistakes, the state has denied him any chance to later demonstrate he is fit to reenter society based solely on non-homicide crime he committed while he was a child in the eyes of the law. This, the Eighth Amendment does not permit. 112 years, the sentence imposed here and the manner imposed here is unconstitutional. We'd ask for the sentence to be vacated and for a resentencing hearing consistent with United States Supreme Court precedent.
Thank you, Ms. Ratliff. The court thanks both you, Ms. Ratliff, and you, Ms. Jones, for your briefs and your excellent oral presentations today. They're very helpful to the court. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes our docket for the day, so the court will be in recess, and the bailiff may so announce.